Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. With me on the show today, Dan Devine of Ball Don't Lie from Yahoo Sports. Dan, how do you do?
I do just fine, thank you. How do you do?
I do quite all right. I'm in a good mood this morning. I'm awake for some reason. I think the draft lottery talk has me fired up because I love the draft, I love the lottery, and I love the spectacle of tanking.
You love the spectacle of tanking. All right, I think that's it's reasonable to love the draft. It's reasonable to love the lottery. It's reasonable to love the drama that surrounds it and the Sturm und Drang that seems to go along with it. I can't stand that we treat this like it's this giant deal, though. It's become such a bummer over the last couple of years. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe we can get into that a little bit.
Yeah, I think the whole like tanking issue for me is I'm fine with tanking as long as we have the current system, because it promotes tanking, and I think it's a smart way to try to build your team through the draft, for one, and two, like, I actually think fans of that team rally behind it, and it's a good thing for them, as opposed to like the rest of us just complain about the Sixers. But I really do think like Sixers fans take a little pride in like, oh no, they've got a process, we're gonna get young players, we're gonna be exciting, we get to, you know, stuff like that, as opposed to just being a crappy team that isn't good, that is always in the lottery.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I mean, the way to sort of, you know, the counterbalance to all this, right, is, you know, like the Bucks. I mean, that's a team that spent the last, you know, however many years, decade or so, of just kind of being like, we feel like we're good enough to get into the Eastern Conference playoffs. I'm like, we're fighting for a playoff berth, and there are plenty of valid reasons to do that. You know, like the civic pride of just, you know, we're not going to be bad. We're going to compete. We're going to work hard. You know, the extra playoff gate that you get from those couple of games before you get swept out of the first round, you know, all that kind of stuff. But that was really the ceiling that they had kind of, you know, put together with that. I mean, some of that is just, you know, not all organizations are going to be run the same way. Some, you know, some decisions will be made more successfully than others. But, you know, there's a reason that Bucks fans, a large share of them, were like, no, we should really stop doing this.
Right.
Like, you know, the way things worked out for them for the best was that their, you know, planned eight seed, you know, blew up last season. And, you know, I wound up sort of winning the lottery by making a really smart, you know, sort of, you know, bold reach for the stars pick in Giannis Antetokounmpo last year. And then this year they come around, they get the number two pick, and they get Jabari Parker. So, like, you know, the turnaround, the thing for fans to be able to grab a hold of and get excited about, comes about not because you say, you know, well, we, you know, embody, you know, kind of a hardworking American ethic of, you know, we're just going to keep sort of striving until eventually we knock over the wall with our head and figure out a way to sort of climb over the wall. So, I mean, I don't know. I think I understand the general point of, if the idea is to compete and to do so honestly and to win, then that should be the idea in all, you know, across the board and sort of all of these, you know, workings and interactions. But yeah, I don't know. I have such a hard time getting sort of agitated about it in the way that it seems like an awful lot of other people do.
Yeah, and I think that I think to your point, like, yeah, the idea is to compete, but I think ultimately isn't like, shouldn't every team's goal be to win to build a championship team, right? And so I think, like, this is the process of building a championship team. Now, it's the process of, like, doing it through intentionally being bad. But if your goal of being bad is to get enough young players who turn into stars, who form a core, who have continuity and chemistry and build through a system and end up, you know, becoming, I don't know, the Thunder or the Spurs or whatever franchise you're trying to model after, that seems like a better thing than just, like, it's not like they're the Clippers of the 90s where they're just being bad because they can still make money, right?
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, right? If the idea is just that we're going to turn a profit, you know, we're going to be cheap and we're going to, you know, take in the revenue sharing and we're going to, you know, turn a profit and that's sort of all we really care about, then obviously that's a problem. I think, you know, the biggest thing to me is, I mean, you're absolutely right, and you know, we've sort of talked about this, you know, in a bunch of different ways. You know, the goal of an NBA team should be to, you know, win an NBA championship, to continually, you know, put yourself in that competitive conversation. You know, like, to give yourself as many shots at it as you can, and to give yourself the best possible shot at it. You know, it's why we, you know, have come around to revere the Spurs in that way. It's why, you know, for so many years, you know, Sam Presti's been viewed as sort of the gold standard among, you know, this new school of GMs, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, the thing, the tanking, or I guess where the tanking argument sort of ends up lying with me, is that the job of an NBA fan, or you know, the purpose of a fan is to, you know, enjoy NBA basketball. So
yeah, that's fair.
So if you've decided, and so I mean, I think at that point we put, you know, let's give the fans that sort of credit and that sort of decision. If you're saying like I wouldn't blame anybody that's like I can't watch the Sixers at all. Like they're what they're doing. Is I understand it, I can intellectually appreciate it, but I don't like it, and I don't want to pay for it, I don't want to watch it, whatever. And if they turn away from the franchise in droves because of that, and, you know, attendance continues to be dismal, and, you know, ratings are terrible, and the gates are awful, and there's, you know, they're not making any money from that stuff, and eventually that reaches the point where ownership is like, this is not working, then, I mean, in that case, then, you know, yeah, your fan base is, you know, informing your strategy. You know, then, I mean, then whatever. Then you could talk about, yeah, like, there's enough of a backlash to this. But I think, generally speaking, as you said, fans kind of understand, you know, when, you know, we'd rather have a plan and be building towards something bigger than just sort of be spinning our wheels. And, you know, with respect to the most recent stuff, like, I mean, if, you know, there was sort of been this joke or this, you know, the joke response to the Sixers not wanting the lottery reform is like, well, of course they don't, because they want to be in the lottery every right. year and they want to, you know, be as high up as they can. But also, yeah, I mean, it all goes back to that general idea of if you have a plan and if you've been working on a plan and you're in the middle of sort of executing that plan, for, you know, the rules to change in the middle, yeah, I can understand being upset about that.
Yeah, and to clarify, like, I'm not, I wish the lottery was unweighted 1 through 14. Like, I think that eliminates tanking, it eliminates this entire conversation, and people will respond with, and have responded with, well, what's to keep a team from dropping out of the playoffs to get a chance at the number one pick? It's like, I don't really think teams are going to pass up the playoff spotlight and the playoff revenue to do so. And so I look at what the Sixers are doing, and I'm envious as a Wolves fan, because the Wolves have been in the lottery for 10 years, not because of a plan to be bad so that they can become good. They're just incompetently run. And so that reality, like, they're not tanking. They just don't know how to build a basketball team. That's much worse than what the, like, I wish they were intentionally being bad to and doing what the Sixers were doing. That's what I want them to do after they trade Kevin Love. I want them to strip it down and do a rebuild like that, because it, like, to me, I can get behind that plan. It's the idea of like, oh, we just suck and we can't draft well, and like that whole mentality as a fan is much more depressing.
Yeah, and I think I come at it from a little bit of a different fan perspective. You know, we've talked before. You know, I'm a Knicks fan, and so obviously the draft has not really been a big part of my life over the course of the last decade or so.
Right.
But you know, there's never been any question that the Knicks were willing to spend to build a winner. There was never any question that they were willing to, you know, go aggressively after what they perceived to be top talent. You know, in a vacuum, the general stuff about the way that the Knicks have approached team building, you know, or maybe would have approached team building in a sport that didn't have any kind of salary cap or issues like that, would, you know, is the kind of thing that a fan would want. You know, like, our owner's willing to spend, our front office is willing to be aggressive. But yeah, like, when the plan, such as there is one, constantly changes every couple of years, and when you don't really necessarily feel like there is a long-term strategy or people that are, you know, mature enough to commit to it or those sorts of things, then, yeah, it becomes frustrating from a fan perspective. So if we're going to give fans enough credit to say, you know, they recognize bad basketball product and they don't believe it should be supported, and if we're going to give fans enough credit to say, you know, these people deserve, you know, the good old college try from their team every night, then maybe we should give fans enough credit to say, you know, they'll understand when their teams are being incompetently run and would vastly prefer there actually be some sort of strategy behind what's happening.
Right. Do you have a preference on how the NBA draft system is? I mean, some people want the draft eliminated completely, and I disagree with that because I love the draft. I think it's a lot of fun. Do you think it should be unweighted? Do you think it's fine the way it is? Do you like the, you know, the alleged reform of five or six teams, worst teams get the same odds for number one pick? Like, what do you think is a good system?
Honestly, I wouldn't care at all if they didn't change it. I think the amount of discussion about how big a problem tanking is has vastly outstripped the amount of a problem that tanking is.
Yeah.
the talk about it has turned it into like the boogeyman, and I don't think it's like that. I think it's a significantly smaller thing. I guess the general perspective that, like, well, if we can, if we recognize this as a potential issue and a theoretic, you know, like, if there's a, you know, like a philosophical opposition to it, then yeah, I mean, I don't know, by all means, you know, crusade away. But yeah, I, at the risk of sounding, you know, reductive or like an insufficiently passionate basketball guy, I do not care if they change it. Like, I'm fine with it staying the way it is, because I think that on balance, it generally does work. As the teams, because relatively few teams are, you know, really gunning for the absolute worst record in the league. And, you know, even if they, even those that do often don't get it. So it's, I think it generally kind of, it tends to work. I think it's a better, maybe, you know, the worst system of all the systems except for all the other ones we can think of.
Right. I think my favorite part of the whole lottery history is that they had gone to weighted odds, but the weighted odds were pretty even, like 1 through 4, I would say, in the early 90s. And then Orlando got back-to-back number one picks. And they freaked out, and the owners were like, well, this clearly isn't working, like, based off this one incident, so we need to go to more of the current system we have now. And I love that reactionary part of it, because it feels like we're maybe headed in a similar way. Maybe not as crazily reactionary, but it does feel reactionary that it's like, oh, well, we're not crazy about what's going on with this current system, so we're going to change it, instead of, like, let's look at the best system for the NBA.
Yeah, and I think it tends toward like a, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the most recent instances, the response to, you know, we have to change the lottery is that the Cavs won 3 times in 4 years, and it's like, I mean, again, if you think this is well, first off, that certainly wasn't the plan in Cleveland. If we talk about a team that is, you know, racing to the bottom, they weren't going for that. They just sucked. The Kyrie pick, or the pick that wound up being Kyrie, came in trade from the Clippers. So it had really nothing to do with,
right,
you know, Cleveland looking to bottom out. And obviously that was not the plan last year with all the moves that Chris Grant made. I mean, if that was Chris Grant's plan, then he might saw the job. So, I don't know. I think that, you know, the reaction to the need to change all that stuff, I think there's more of a call for it, and more of a, you know, more venom behind the idea that it has to happen than is really warranted. But I also understand, you know, this is something, you know, the people that feel passionately about this feel like crazy passionately about it. And I don't know that I'm able to match them there.
Yeah, that's fair. You mentioned you're a Knicks fan. We've talked about you being a Knicks fan on the podcast before. This team, I'm getting kind of excited about what's happening with the Knicks.
I can hear the tone in your voice. You're going to try to suck me in here.
I'm very pro Phil Jackson. I'm very into this idea of, like, all right, you need a lot of guys to buy in, and you don't, and there aren't any defensive big men on the team other than Sam Dallenberg, which is a problem. But or maybe Cole Aldrich too. I don't want to shortchange him. But I don't know. I know it's only been a couple of months of Phil Jackson, and maybe you're not crazy about the Derek Fisher hire, or maybe you're fine with it, but I just like that they seem to have a direction moving forward. And I don't know, this triangle offense with these weapons, if they buy in, I think they can be fun.
Well, I think my anticipation, I'm very interested to see how it works out, for sure. I think there's a million things to kind of, you know, pick out through, but, you know, I don't know that I believe Derek Fisher is going to be a great head coach, especially not right away. But if Derek Fisher can be like a value neutral head coach, then I think that's probably an improvement over the way that things ended with Mike Woodson. Like, I think, yeah, and not that Mike Woodson isn't a good coach, but that by the end of that, his tenure there, he was like kind of actively, he was like looking for reasons not to play his best lineup and to, you know, sort of submarine the confidence of some of the players that, you know, that might be valuable there, and like kind of unwilling to kick over rocks to try to help out some of the, you know, the deficiencies on the team, the kind of the glaring ones. So, I mean, if there's a, you know, even if Derek Fisher is just sort of like, okay, well, this guy might be, you know, good in this role, or like, you know, we don't have any shot blocking or rebounding, you know, yeah, okay, let's give Cole Aldrich a couple of minutes and see what can happen. Or, you know, let's, you know, Bargnani is kind of killing us whenever we, you know, when we play him, especially when we play him alongside Amare. Let's kind of try to figure out how to pair him just with somebody who can be like a defensive, you know, helper. You know, I think if there are those sorts of ideas, I think that could be helpful. I mean, the upgrade from Raymond Felton to Jose Calderon, well, obviously it's not an upgrade on the defensive end, but it's, you know, there really wasn't a whole lot going on. I think we talked about it, you know, Ray Felton might have been like my pick for the most disappointing player, like in the maybe in the league last year. But, you know, I mean, Calderon is a guy who's not going to turn the ball over a lot and is going to hit open shots and is going to make smart plays. I think, you know, increasing that level of improvement, even just a couple of those things, you know, like slightly better rotation, slightly better decision making, and better play at the point could wind up getting them back to be like a 500 level, you know, just sort of on its own. You know, you've got, I mean, the thing that I'm kind of interested to see how it works out this summer, if all kind of goes according to plan, neither J.R. Smith nor Iman Shumpert will be coming off of knee surgeries. And I think that could be really helpful on the wing, you know, especially because, you know, for all the things that are crazy about JR, like when he has been engaged and healthy and then, like, you know, buying into what he's supposed to be doing and feels like he's, you know, supported and believed in, he actually can be kind of helpful defensively and on the glass and as a, you know, secondary ball handler, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, if, you know, he's healthy and you know, he comes into the season that way, that could be there. I mean, Shumpert obviously has been sort of a shell of himself in terms of his confidence over the last couple of years. So, you know, maybe a fresh start and a healthy year for him comes back. Yeah, I mean, there are reasons to be sort of excited about the pieces around the edges. But, you know, I guess to a certain extent, it kind of all depends on whether they get, you know, last year plus out of Melo, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, they still need him to be – well, one, they need him to buy into the triangle. And,
right.
And, I mean, that's important. I think maybe almost as important, even though he's clearly not the same level of player, is getting JR to buy into the triangle, because he's so talented, even though he's, you know, his mentality is more my style of play, which is not a good thing. But I think that, you know, those are obviously important. Having to, you know, getting some kind of production out of the Amare Bargnani duo, with whether they're together or not, which they shouldn't be, but just getting some kind of consistent production that you can feel like you rely on in short spurts on a nightly basis, like, and that's obviously asking a lot. Like, that's clearly important, but I do just think, like, this, they've had talent, and, you know, whether the 54 win team was a smokescreen or was actually legitimate, like, that was a team who could shoot the ball from outside, and they were just kind of an annoying pest out there, and they were able to take advantage of, you know, a weaker conference, and that's what, you know, that's why they were successful. And then last year they didn't completely go away from it, but they went away from so much that made them good. And now, you know, you upgrade the point guard position back, and you have a sharing system, and if Melo buys in, like, I don't know, I don't know that Derek Fisher is going to be a good coach, like you said, and I think the whole idea of him just being a neutral entity on the sideline, like, I think that's part of the reason why Scott Brooks is successful. And I know we rail against Scott Brooks for various decisions, but I don't think he's a bad coach. I think for the most part, like, he doesn't hurt them when you factor in, like, their preparation and his development of players and all this stuff. Like, I think there are a lot of good qualities for Scott Brooks. And maybe once you get to a title contending team, then the negativity shows through, you know, if you want to really pick it apart that closely. But if Fisher's that for them, like, that's a big upgrade over what Mike Woodson was the last year.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the big problem, you know, and you touched on it earlier, is that the defense was bad last year, and it very well could be worse this year. Tyson Chandler, it's kind of a shame because, on the way out, Tyson Chandler, I think there are a lot of Knicks fans who feel like he was sort of, an underperformer in the context of what they needed him to be. And I guess if what they needed him to be was basically the only guy on the team that played defense and could erase everybody's mistakes.
Right.
So I guess, you know, in that context, yeah, you know, like, I mean, he didn't do that every game all the time perfectly. But I think, you know, I mean, the combination of you know, the injuries that he suffered, the fact that he had, like, no respite. I mean, he came back from his broken leg last year, and then I think one of his first games back, or maybe even the first game back, was that the overtime game against the Bucks where Bargnani took, like, the inexplicable shot.
Right.
Where if he just, you know, took the air out of the ball, they win. Instead, they go to overtime, and he plays another, like, 6 minutes. He played something like 36 minutes in his first game back from a broken leg, because they had to have him out there against the Bucks, by the way.
Right.
I mean, that sort of, by the end of the line, that just becomes a, you know, like, I can't imagine how he was even getting up for work and going, like, all right, man, it's another day of nobody stopping anything on the perimeter and me having to, you know, constantly try to tell people where they need to go and it not working anyway, and I'm not going to get the ball, and
yeah.
Screw it.
And well, and it wasn't, like, towards the end of the year, like, he wouldn't even answer questions about defense. Like, it seemed like he was so broken, and that's why some people have said, like, don't overreact to him going back to Dallas, and I just, like, I've described it as, well, once he gets that Knicks, like, sludge deloused off of him, like, I actually think he's going to be really good again. Like, not defensive player of the year good, but I think he's better than what he was broken into.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, with I think the thing that, you know, where he got toward the end of that season and wasn't really looking at, he's like, I don't even really want to talk about this anymore. I think part of it is because, you know, every time he was asked about it, or every time they talked about it, he would talk about, you know, like, you know, we're not really buying into this scheme, or this isn't really the way it's supposed to work, or this might not be the best way to maximize our personnel on this end of the ball. Like, the idea that we were switching everything, and there were sort of these, like, aggressive tendencies that led players who sort of already tended to be out of position into being more out of position, like, and then, you know, making his job harder to clean up behind them. So, I mean, again, going back to that sort of idea, you know, we can kind of impose whatever you know, systems or beliefs or whatever we want to on Derek Fisher at this point, because we don't really, outside of the triangle on offense, we don't really know what else he wants to do.
Right.
So you say, like, all right, well, even if what they play is like a super vanilla conservative type of defense, you know, where it's just try to keep as many things in front of you, try to, you know, you defend your man, try to keep him in front of you, don't help super aggressively off the ball, and we kind of see where we go from there, you know, that might, even with limited defensive personnel, which obviously they have, you know, it might, reduce some of the fires that sort of got created in some of those crazy rotations the Knicks got brought into last year. But, you know, I mean, yeah, and with respect to Chandler, like, I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of a bummer because, you know, the guy he was at the end of his tenure there, like you said, what he got sort of sludged into or broken into, it was not someone that was going to be sort of consistently helpful for them as constituted, but he was awesome his first year in New York, and was a much more valuable offensive player, just given the gravity of where he was in the pick and roll. You know, that not only that he was, like, basically the only screener, but that he was like a kind of a terrifying dive man for, like, a year and a half there. He put in work. He was a guy that sort of stood up and got and was counted in his time there. So it's kind of a bummer that it ended the way it did. You know, I don't know that he's ever going to be that defensive player of the year type of guy again in Dallas, but in a system where there are rules that he understands with personnel that he sort of is familiar with, and a coach that knows how to get the best out of him, yeah, I figure he'll probably bounce back a little bit this year too.
Yeah, I think that he gets to return to, like, a level of trust within an organization and an idea and teammates and stuff, and something that was kind of just not there last year for the situation he was in, whether he was a part of that or whether he is just a victim of that, or maybe it's both, I don't know. But yeah, it does seem like he gets to have, like, a little fresh start at the end of his career. Explain to me the Knicks fan perception of what Tim Hardaway Jr. is and will be.
Oh, geez.
Because there was the report that, I don't know what was the offer, allegedly, that the Knicks gave for Kevin Love. It was like Amari, Hardaway Jr., and like Shumpert or something like that.
Right.
And it seemed like some of the Knicks fans on Twitter seemed very offended that Tim Hardaway Jr. was included.
Right, like that was too much to give up for Kevin Love.
Right.
Well, I think, okay, I'll offer two things here. Understand that there's an irrational undercurrent of Knicks fandom that is, you know, like it rivals every other fan base's irrationality.
Sure.
It can be, you know, staggering and electric and kind of wonderful to behold from a distance. I think people look at Tim Hardaway Jr. and see a guy that can score in bunches, a guy that's a, when his shot's falling, when he's, he's got his, sort of his whole offensive game working, which, I mean, at this point primarily is just him scoring and either shooting from the outside off catch and shoots or taking people off the dribble or getting out in transition. He's not a very good passer. He's not a very willing passer. He's not... he doesn't sort of have that next level of offensive awareness yet. And there's some question as to whether he'll ever develop it. But I think people look at the fact that he can put the ball in the basket, and he was like often the only guy not named Carmelo Anthony that could do that regularly last year, especially with JR kind of, fluctuating throughout the season. And they say, well, you need a second guy to score, and he can score. And then, of course, I mean, that's sort of the general understanding. You then tend to completely disavow the other side of the floor, which is where Tim Hardaway Jr., struggles. I think, and that's, kind of a kind way to put it. That he was a, all rookies struggle on defense. Yeah. It's about, especially, guards and perimeter players. Like, that's really tough to sort of figure out how to start, checking good twos and threes at the NBA level coming out of college. He struggled more than a lot of them, and I don't know that there are a whole lot of people who believe that he's going to transform into an average defender at the NBA level. I think there's sort of a general idea that his best role is going to be like a guy who can get you buckets in a hurry, but that's kind of about it, and might give up about as much as he might give back as much as he takes,
Right.
But that said, I mean, yeah, like Knicks fans are I think they see the scoring and they're like, oh no, that guy's, because scoring is what matters, again, in this context, that guy's an all-star in the making, and he's a young guy that's cheap and he can score, so why would we get rid of him? You can kind of understand Knicks fans being gun-shy given just the sheer amount of young guys that have gotten traded away and been helpful somewhere else.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that there's a it's like anything else. There's an overvaluation of scoring talent and an under recognition of how much defense matters.
Is it? Because I think a lot of people outside of Knicks fandom have looked at him and especially very harshly judged the way he played in Summer League, and said like, oh, this guy's just another J.R. Smith. I don't think that's a fair. Kind of comparison I don't think that's really a fair comparison for what he is or what he'll become, but I guess I can see the similarities. I'm also someone who likes guys that will just go out there and score. I think we went so far in one way regarding efficiency and being able to be an all-around player and stuff that we've gone and undervalued scoring. Not saying scoring is everything, and I certainly know, like, you throw in the warts of Monte Ellis and Jamal Crawford and Nick Young and all these guys that I love. I get that, but I do think we do undervalue a guy who could just go out there and put up a bunch of points in a short amount of time.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's at the end of the game, you have to have more points than the other guys, and whether you do that by outscoring them or stopping, or by, like, your offense is overpowering theirs or your defense can smother them, like, at the end, or some combination in the middle, ideally, you have to do that, and you need guys who can score to do that. I guess where I fall on it is, I can certainly understand if you were to tell me, like, the Knicks are just looking to recoup picks, and they want to trade Tim Hardaway Jr. for, like, a collection of second-rounders in the years to come, I would be like, well, I don't know about that, because I mean, he's on his rookie deal. He's young. He's one of the relatively few players on that Knicks roster right now who very well could improve over the course of the next few years. Right. And where you don't know exactly what his ceiling is yet. So maybe while it's very possible that the Knicks could get several quality pieces with second rounders, it's also possible that be able to use multiple picks to, in a trade down the line, like when, the Blazers got Thomas Robinson for a pair of second rounders, things like that. Like they're useful assets, whether you use them for yourself or in combination with something else. I might be a little bit more reluctant to do that, but if he has an NBA skill right now, and that skill does have value, even if we've tended to kind of, undervalue or undercut it a little bit of late. That said, if you're talking about, I don't know if we can part with Tim Hardaway Jr. in a Kevin Love trade, right. then I think you need to kind of recalibrate your expectations of what Tim Hardaway Jr. is and could be, and also what Kevin Love is. But I think what was hilarious about that report, and I believe it was Chris Herring in the Wall Street Journal, who's amazing, a great Knicks beat writer, that reported that, was that the immediate reaction from like every other fan base was, I can't believe that Phil Jackson would even like form his mouth to make that offer, like to put that in the world. And that Knicks fans, a segment of Knicks fans, at least, was like, yeah, I know, I can't believe he would give up that much. So I think it tends to kind of point toward that, the difficulty that fans have sometimes in terms of overvaluing their own guys, undervaluing other players around the league. But yeah, I mean, shockingly, those talks didn't seem to go anywhere.
Earlier, you described Tim Hardaway Jr. as staggering and electric and something to behold from a distance. And I just want to let you know that I assume you're going to have this responsibility of, when I die, I would like you to make sure that's put on my tombstone, because that's how I want to be described as well.
Well, I appreciate that you like the turn of phrase there, but let's both, you and me, do ourselves a favor and not put ourselves in that position for a long, long time.
Sure. Yeah. No. I'm a good 8 years down the road, anywhere in the 8 to 60 year range. But I just like I'm on record of saying that you have that responsibility for me. I think you could just make people do that too.
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the way the law works.
Yeah. No. I'm pretty sure this is a binding contract. Right. This is kind of a two-part question of, one, the Knicks are scheduled to have a good amount of cap room next year, next mm-hmm. summer, assuming we don't know what they're going to do with trades and stuff in the interim, but I think they'll have room for, it looks like a max level deal, mm-hmm. and in the next 2 years there are some very real, very good free agents that will be available, and now you have a president in Phil Jackson who maybe is going to be the next Pat Riley type guy who can just throw his rings on the table and say, hey, come join us. We know how to do it. Like, we're going to know how to build stuff. What are your feelings about the future of that? I mean, the last time they had huge cap space, they signed Amari Stoudemire, which was a good deal until he got hurt, right?
Right.
Do you feel like this is going to be a fruitful venture into next summer or the next two summers, and do you feel good about Phil Jackson being that guy?
Well, I mean, it's always going to be an adventure. I think we can safely say that.
Sure.
Fruitful might be a different matter. I don't know. I mean, the name, the obviously, as we've seen over the course of the last week or 2 weeks, however long this chat has really started to get louder. The name that's out there in a couple summers that everyone's talking about is Kevin Durant, obviously,
right.
And the most prominent connections being made there at this point are with the Wizards because of the hometown DC thing and et cetera. I mean, we're kind of starting the clock pretty early on that, but
that's what we do now.
It's well, yeah, right. As soon as somebody signs, it's the question is, well, where are they going to be in 5 years? But if you're going into a job interview someplace, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And it's like, I don't know, two teams away. the name, if you're a Knicks fan, the name that you would be most, or you should be most excited about, if you had to sort of, make a wish, would be Marc Gasol. Because
ooh.
Say again?
No, I like that. I said, ooh, I like that idea.
Oh, I thought you said who, and I was missing a goof. I apologize. I'm like, no, he's this big Spanish dude. I think you've seen him. But you talk about, as you said, the lack of defensive bigs on the Knicks roster. Obviously he is, one of the premier defensive big men in the league. He's also not necessarily an athleticism-dependent big man, so, there might be a chance that a longer term deal for him, even if it would take him into his early to mid-30s, might age, fairly well. And obviously, in terms of, high post passing or, post play, sort of elbows, foul line extended shooting, that sort of thing, the kinds of things that could be really, that could pair well with a triangle system, I think Gasol would make an awful lot of sense. That said, every summer now, half the league or more has, giant amounts of cap space. What they don't have are, defensive player of the year caliber big men who can also initiate offense. So I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope necessarily for that. But I think that's, if you're asking where I think Phil Jackson needs to look, it's more on that side of the ball. Like you've already established that Carmelo Anthony is going to probably take up at least a third of your possessions. I mean, it's just because it's what he does. You know,
right.
his career usage rate is somewhere around 33% or so. It certainly has been with the Knicks over the last 2.5-3 years. So. He's probably going to continue to eat up that level of possessions. Maybe they share the ball a little bit better or differently in a triangle system. But still, even when they were a spread pick and roll, fire the ball around the perimeter, everybody moving the ball team, he was still taking up that a third of the possession. So it's much more about how you build around him. I know it's sort of become a cliche issue to make the comparison, but in that 2011 Mavericks kind of way of. You can have an offensive, sort of all offense, power forward scorer as your sort of focal point on that side, but then you have to build the defensive shell around him and the playmaking shell around him, and I think that's sort of the idea you have to look at. As far as how confident I am in Phil Jackson, I mean, it really remains to be seen, right? I mean, there have been sort of pluses and minuses this summer insofar as like. He didn't get his first choice even for head coach, right? Even with a willingness to, pay a pretty exorbitant fee for a first time coach in Steve Kerr, he didn't get him. And so I think that kind of was the first hit in the idea that Phil Jackson walks into a room, says, "I want you, you, and you," and he just walks out with them. That might not be the case because context matters and other opportunities are going to be there, especially for players in free agency. That said, I think you have to feel at least somewhat positive about the fact that he turned some kind of declining assets into maybe some younger players that have some future. Like I mean, I think Jose Calderon's a better fit for this year. Shane Larkin might have some promise. Guys like Donatas Adetokounmpo might have some promise. Clay Anthony Early might have some promise. Like young guys that may have some runway to sort of lean into, which the Knicks haven't had a whole lot of those guys in recent years. But those obviously aren't home runs. Those are like getting on base. For a Knicks front office that has really had trouble getting on base very much over the course of the last few years, I think that's a step forward. But I think you feel more confident with him making those moves if, in fact, he really does have the power to kind of keep James Dolan out of the way. So far, so good, but we're still talking about, 5 months?
Right.
I mean,
and
on nothing of major consequence yet. So, I don't know. I mean, I think there's reason for optimism, but that optimism had best to be cautious.
Yeah, I think that I look at the 2010, and they it wasn't like they were just blindly spending and just trying to get anybody. Like, I do feel like they had Mike D'Antoni in place, and whatever people think of him as a coach, like I think if you give him his system and what he can do and the players he likes, like I think he's a pretty good coach. And mm-hmm. and they seem to have a plan. It's just LeBron wouldn't go there, and so then that really they had to go down the checklist of who would go there. And I think they were looking at Joe Johnson for a while and ended up with Amari Stoudemire. And it looks bad now, but at the time, it wasn't like it was just the Knicks freewheeling, trying to get anybody, trying to just spend money to spend money like it was in the past. Like, it did seem they had a plan, and mm-hmm. it just didn't work out, and they couldn't get who they wanted. So maybe it's not so different as it is now. I think maybe now it's just a bigger, cooler name with Phil Jackson.
Oh, no, yeah, for sure. I think, the way to sort of line that stuff up, right, is that was, a lot of that was Donnie Walsh, right?
Right,
that was Donnie Walsh in the front office and was brought in after a lot of those free spending, kind of constantly pinballing back and forth among plans and strategies, brought in to clean out the cap, get rid of a lot of that dead money, get rid of a lot of, underperforming assets and try to build towards something that would be like a sustainable path forward. And they did that by clearing out all that money for 2010. They didn't get their their number one or number two options or whatever, but they landed a big fish free agent, which was something to get the fans excited about. And even after sort of striking out and on the big fish they wanted, the roster that was sort of constructed around that one big deal had a lot of movable pieces, a lot of flexibility. There were picks still coming in. There was, there were tools to be used for building a roster. And the inflection point there, and also that roster was, with the exception of last season or 2 seasons ago now, that was like the most fun Knicks team. That first half of the season was like the most fun Knicks team in a decade because
right.
they were playing that D'Antoni style. you know, Felton and Amari were working well in the pick and roll together. You know, there were some guys to be excited about Gallinari, and then like randomly Timofey Mozgov's in the mix, and you know, they looks like they figured something out with a second rounder and Landry Fiel and all these sorts of things. There were things to be like, okay, well, you know, maybe they're, you know, these guys could either become something fun on their own or be built into something bigger later. And then the inflection point, of course, is the Melo deal, where, you know, depending on who you listen to or, you know, who you believe there, it's that, you know, Walsh didn't necessarily want to make, he wanted Carmelo on the team, but maybe didn't want to make the kind of deal they wound up making that was sort of an asset strip mining deal,
right.
And that, you know, he got sort of big boy by the owner there. So, and then of course after that happened, you know, Walsh is not long for the world, and he leaves and winds up back in Indiana, and then there's still a little bit more of that, like, I don't know really what we do next, and the plan sort of changes, and now there's again kind of a reputed grown-up in the room to say this is how we build a team.
Right.
For the first time in a few years.
Yeah, which is probably the most important thing when dealing with James Dolan.
Because
he can't really get out of his own way with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that was, I mean, with all of this stuff, and again, it's still very tentative because we haven't had one of those big decision points yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, the biggest sort of outcome of the Phil Jackson era so far is that Dolan kind of had to publicly say, like, I'm not the basketball expert here. I'm not the guy who should be making decisions. I'm going to leave that to, you know, this is why I'm hiring Phil, and I'm going to leave it to him. And that he sort of maintained that company line over the last handful of months. If that continues, and I mean, and whether it's, you know, then the plans such as they are will be allowed to succeed or fail on their own merits. And I think that's actually, I mean, for you, I mean, this might just be sort of rose-colored glasses, but you can also see the appeal of that for Dolan insofar as, like, eventually you've got to get sick of being considered the jerk, right? Like,
eventually,
have to get sick of being considered the guy who is the reason it all goes wrong. Now you can say, well, all right, you wanted me to pay top dollar for a guy, you know, for a brilliant basketball mind, I've done that. You wanted me to retain our signature star, so that we can have something, you know, worth building around. I've done that. You wanted a high-profile coach, coaching hire. Well, we didn't get, you know, Phil Jackson in his prime, but we got, you know, a system that people believe in and a hot name on the market. We've got that. I'm gonna step back. You guys do your thing, and then if it works, I'm a genius for stepping out of the way. And if it doesn't work, I'm not the guy who got his finger in it. So, I mean, you could see sort of the argument there, but yeah, very much remains to be seen if he's able to stay out of, you know, continue to sort of stay out of the limelight and see where it goes.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know if these are fair comparisons, but talking about, like, not wanting to be the jerk anymore and not wanting to be in the way with James Dolan, like, made me think of, one, the Blazers with Paul Allen, how there was just so much chaos in the last decade with that team in the front office. And, you know, the injuries certainly piled up and added a lot of pressure, but there was just so much chaos. And now it seems like you at least don't hear about him all that much anymore. And it's more of like just Neil O'Shea does his thing. He's really smart. He is putting a team together that is very good in the playoffs, growing together, and seems to have like just a bright future. And then I also thought of Donald Sterling in a way of like, they were such a joke for 30 years, and then they went out. You know, Blake Griffin becomes a star either by accident or like they figured out that they got that star and weren't going to screw it up. And then they make the Chris Paul trade, and then you go out and get Doc Rivers. Like, in a way, they kind of, you know, Donald Sterling got out of his own way momentarily until he became, you know, a recorded racist for I don't know the umpteenth time in his life. But in those ways, like, there is kind of that thing of like, You're such a figure for the organization, but you don't always have to be the face of the organization, even when you own it. And maybe there's some kind of in between there with Dolan and now the whole Phil Jackson thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a Knicks fan's perspective, it'd be nice if that was the case.
Yeah,
I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, you can. It's hard. It can be difficult to put yourself in the same frame of mind because if you're the guy, I mean, you're the guy signing those checks.
Yeah.
Like, of course you want credit for it, right? Of course you want to have your say. Of course you like all that sort of stuff. So, in that context, it's hard to blame him for being like, no, of course I want a voice in this decision-making process. Even though, as you say, you know, there are multiple examples of things starting to get better when that has sort of, that loud voice has kind of receded or you just kind of stayed quiet for a little bit. And there are, you know, myriad examples of ownership not taking that active role and the team having, you know, more success because, you know, the people who are, you know, hired to make decisions then make decisions. I think that's the thing. Like, it's easy to understand why owners, if you were an owner, if you're a billionaire, and if you own just, you know, you own this massively valuable property and whatever, like, I can see the attraction in being Mark Cuban, like wanting to be the guy who is, you know, out in the front, the face of the franchise, the one who's, you know, it all sort of hangs on his shoulders. He gets tons of credit for being willing to spend top dollar and his facilities and, you know, the sort of innovative ideas and all these things. But that's much more the exception than proves that proves the rule, right? I mean, like,
even he is far less demonstrative than he was in the past.
Exactly, right. So yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, but there's still that sort of understanding that, like, well, if you're, you know, you can be out front and you can be successful, I think that's harder to pull off.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird balance. By the way, you're very good. Carmelo Anthony's usage rate with the Knicks, 33.1%.
Boom!
Yeah, that's dead on, as Marissa Tomei would say, that's dead on balls accurate.
Well, listen, I mean, this is not the first time this morning that I've been compared to Marissa Tomei.
Sure. I know it's a cliche comparison with you and Marissa, but I just thought I'd throw it out there anyway.
I do appreciate it.
Before I let you go, I'm curious about this because you do have some responsibility on Ball Don't Lie with the 10-man rotation, which links out, you know, some of the most interesting writing of the day for the NBA world. Do you feel pressure? And do you ever, like, I'm sure there are people like, oh, that will tweet, like, oh, I didn't get included on the 10-man today with this piece. Like, do you ever feel like, is there, like, that just seems like a lot of pressure on such a, like, a big publication to such a big platform to, like, get that work out and not miss something. And I will just throw the caveat of, like, I wrote a Dwayne Wade thing today and this podcast will be up in plenty of time for the 10-man, but no pressure at all.
Yeah, no. Listen, the Wade post is it's up in a tab. I got it. I mean, as you know, everybody that does these jobs, you have like, you know, before you hit 9 a.m. East Coast time, you have like 300 tabs open.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. That's something that is, you know, it's been part of the site, part of Ball Don't Lie since it's like inception, really. I think that might have been, you know, when Kelly Dwyer was running the site even before like J.E. Skeets got there. Like, it's a long running feature. And I've kind of taken on a little bit more responsibility for it over the last couple of years just because of the way the time constraints work. And it's, to be honest, it kind of works the other way. Like, I mean, the explosion of great basketball writing kind of continues, and as the number of sites and outlets doing it and independent outlets doing it, like all these things kind of continue to grow, you just can't see everything, but you try, you know, I try to keep, you know, cast a pretty wide net, and I, you know, I'll periodically kind of remind people, like, you can send me things, you can point me in directions, if you see something that you think would be worth it, you know, or that you think I should take a look at, please, by all means. Sometimes that results in just sort of getting spammed, like people saying to you, you know, in case you missed it, here's this thing I wrote, in case you missed it, here's this thing I wrote, in case you missed it, here's this thing I wrote, and you're like, you know how I can't miss it? because you've sent me 7 tweets about it in the last hour and a half. But it tends to work the other way, I think, insofar as I think, you know, you've taken me to task sternly in the past about being uncomfortably nice.
You are uncomfortably nice. Be mean.
Well, but the thing is this. I think that the reason, one of the reasons I think I'm able to be in kind of a nice place with a lot of the you know, the writers that we know and, you know, and in sort of this world is that, like, people are, like, when I find something, when someone doesn't, like, promote it to me and I'm like, I liked this, people seem to dig that and people seem to feel good about it. And, like, even, I mean, for me, I like doing that. I think it's, I mean, we've moved away as a blog culture, I think, from those sort of linked up things. And I totally understand why, because they take a lot of time to put together and it can be hard to do all sort of the reading associated with it.
Right.
While you're also writing a handful of things a day and trying to work on other projects. But I think there's value to it. I think there's sort of a community value to it. And, you know, when you talk to people that are like, you know, from sort of the covers, you know, maybe, you know, less glamorous teams or that don't always, you know, get, like, you know, big run on, you know, major national sites for, like, interesting analysis of the Utah Jazz, say, and, like, you kind of put a link out there, like, hey, this is actually kind of a cool way of looking at, you know, something, you know, an issue that they've got going on or whatever, people tend to appreciate that. So, I mean, for me, there's, like, a value to it insofar as I like being liked, and And I like, you know, so people sort of appreciate when those links come their way. I get that. I'll kind of wrap it that way. I get that a lot more than I get, why don't you link me? I get like, you know, it's like, thank you for seeing that thing. Thank you for linking that thing out. Much more than I get, like, he's a hater and I don't get that. Although maybe that's just subtweets that I don't see. I don't know.
But by the way, that Kelly Dwyer you work with, and Eric Freeman's quite good as well. That Kelly Dwyer's a smart guy.
Yes, yeah, he is. But it's fun. It's like we overlap in taste, I think, but hardly ever in like form or style, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like there are a lot of really. You know, wonderful teams at different sort of, you know, or you know, like you know, teams at different national sites, and you know, obviously with you and Matt and now James, and the, you know, sort of the pipeline of talent that's come through CBS, and you know, there are, you know, people at Grantland, people at ESPN, and sort of all over the place that have you know, sort of built really interesting teams. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there are. I think we're going to be going into like our fourth or fifth season as like a full team. Which is kind of weird. It's weird that like there's so much turnover and churn in this stuff that
yeah.
It kind of like we've kind of linked, you know, stuck together as an overlapping team for a while, and that's I think but you see that in terms of, like we all kind of stake out little different areas, I think, and you know, we can sort of interchange and do different stuff, but yeah, Kelly's you know, it's always sort of a privilege to work with him, and Eric is. Phenomenal, and you know, those guys, you know, make me run laps every day, but to try to keep up with them. So, yeah, it's good. But yeah, and I'll cap that by saying, listeners out there, if you are someone who wants me to see something for 10 Men and you feel like I'm not seeing it, you can get at me on Twitter. My email address is on there. You know, I'm always willing to consider more stuff. But yeah, just if it doesn't get there, you know, reserve those hate tweets. I don't need that.
Right. I'll just say it for you. If it doesn't get there, it's because it sucked.
Well, I know what I appreciate.
Oh wait, I think that's why I'm not liked. I think it's for stuff like that.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I try to keep the number of people who I call legit garbage to like a real minimum every day.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Well, we can read it on Yahoo.com. Ball don't lie. Follow you on Twitter @YourManDivine. And Dan, it's always a pleasure, and I'm happy to talk to you.
Zach, thanks so much for having me back, man. I appreciate it.